Welcome to Growth Marketing Today, where marketers, designers, and product owners level up their growth marketing chops from experts in today's top startups. Here's your host, Ramley John.
Hey, welcome to episode 58 of Growth Marketing Today. I'm your host, Ramley John, and I'm here on a mission to help marketers and founders like you sharpen their marketing skills by talking to some of today's top marketing experts. In this episode, I have somebody that you might have heard of. His name is Nir Eyal. He is the Wall Street Journal best-selling author of Hooked, which is all about designing products that gets people hooked on your product. He just published a new book today called Indistractable. Now, so high-achieving marketers and founders, you must know that getting meaningful work done in a world full of distraction is kind of hard. We get pings from Slack, notification from mail. We get so distracted by Twitter and social media, or maybe that's just me. When you become indistractable, your attention and your life becomes your own to focus on tasks that help you achieve the next growth milestone in your company. That's why in this episode 58, what you're going to learn from Nir Eyal talking about his new book, Indistractable, is what does indistractable mean? It's actually not a word in the dictionary. Second, four strategies to turn distraction into traction so you can get real work done and help achieve growth in your company. And third, what are some responsibilities that marketers and founders have to create in products that don't distract people too much? Now, in this episode, I have created a growth cheat sheet, maybe more like an indistractable cheat sheet, if you know what I mean. Why take notes when you can steal mine? Take my notes on how to become more focused and achieve more at work from my talk with Nir Eyal. You can download the growth cheat sheet for this episode now at growthtoday.fm/58, or you can find the link in the description of wherever you get your podcasts. Now, please support this podcast. I'm not sure if you know, this podcast is a one-person show. My name is Ramley. I record, edit, and create all the marketing materials for this podcast. It's a lot of work. So there's three ways you can support it. I made it easy for you. First, you can tell a friend about it. Share a quote on Twitter or LinkedIn. I've created some tweetable quotes on growthtoday.fm/58. Second, you can join the Growth Today Tribe mailing list so you'll get all the cheat sheets directly emailed to you going forward. I'll also tell you who my next guests are, so you can ask them questions via email. And third, you can support me on Patreon for as little as $2 per episode for some exclusive content and access. You can go to patreon.com/growthtoday, or you can find that link in the description below. Now, my first 20 Patreons, you'll get all the perks at the highest level, which is the unicorn level, for $2 per episode, which is 75% off. I will also thank you in every episode for the rest of the year. So that's why I want to thank my early adopter Patreons right now. Jamie Ward from Las Vegas, Veronica from London, UK, Fabricio Marcias from Brazil, and I have a new one from last week. Yep, that's right. Nicholas from Sydney. I really do appreciate all of you for making this podcast happen. Anyways, enough about me. Let's listen in my chat with Nir Eyal. Hey everybody, I'm so excited to have Nir Eyal here. He is here to talk about his new book. How are you doing, Nir?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I can't complain. It's nice and hot here in Toronto. I think you mentioned to me that you're in New York. What are you doing there?
I'm in sunny Manhattan. This is where I live now. I moved from San Francisco about 2 years ago now, and so now I'm in warm New York.
That's pretty awesome. We're actually almost neighbors by flight, I guess. I'm so excited to talk about your book, but before we jump into talking about Indistractable, can you tell me a little bit about your story? I looked up your LinkedIn, and I didn't know you volunteered at Peace Corps for inner city public school.
Well, AmeriCorps, yeah, not the Peace Corps, but AmeriCorps. It's
AmeriCorps, similar. Sorry.
Yeah, it's a domestic Peace Corps. Yeah, that was back in 1996. It was only the second year the program existed, and I took a gap year between high school and college to do that.
And how did you get from there to writing these two books?
Well, let's see. So I went from direct service. I was very much about, you know, wanting to change the world and figuring out ways to give back to this country. I'm a very proud American. I was born in Israel, but I grew up in my adopted home of the United States. And I've been here since I was 3 years old. And I wanted a way to give back, but didn't want to go into the Army. And so I thought this was the next best thing, to do the AmeriCorps program. And then I went to college, and I took some economics classes that helped me understand the systemic sources of problems and how behavior can be changed through incentives. I mean, that's really what economics is all about, is around how incentives change people's behaviors. And, you know, learning this, an economics view of the world compared to my direct service experience in AmeriCorps was kind of a pivotal moment, because I thought the way to change the world was to just go out there and change it, right? Do it. But then I realized that, wow, you know, through business, you can actually have an incredible impact on society by building the kind of products and services that improve people's lives. And so it doesn't necessarily have to be about direct service. You can actually improve people's lives through systemic changes. And there's no better way I've seen to improve the average standard of living than through technological innovation powered by the profit motive. And so, you know, with a lot of caveats there, I know that the capitalist system is not perfect. It just happens to be better than any other system we've seen. And, you know, I think our current form of capitalism is also not perfect. I think we have a lot of instances of crony capitalism, but I think it's an ideal that I think I strive for, and that I really do believe that products and services can really improve people's lives. And so that's why I got into business. So I went to Boston Consulting Group to learn strategic consulting and think big picture about, you know, I wanted to, you know, work directly with the biggest companies in America to see how they work and how I might be able to help and learn from the best of them. And I did that for 2 years. I was miserable. I did not like that profession at all. But I decided to go into business for myself. I started a solar energy company, and then that was acquired 3 years later. And then I went off to Stanford Business School, started another company. That was acquired a few years later. And then after I had some time between things, I started writing and blogging about this area that I learned a lot about in my former company, which was around behavioral design. How do you use consumer psychology to change people's lives, to improve their lives? And so I had a hypothesis around habits and how important habits would be in the future of technological innovation. That, you know, I had this hypothesis that as the interface shrinks, as we went from desktops to laptops to mobile devices to wearable devices and now to audible devices like the Amazon Alexa, as the interface shrank, habits become increasingly important. So I wanted to find a book on how to build habit-forming products, and I couldn't find such a book. So I decided to write it myself. And so I decided to work on this book. And then in the meantime, one of my old professors at Stanford called me up and said, "Look, I really like your blog. I think you're doing some good work here. What if we taught a class together?" And so that led to me teaching at the Stanford Graduate School of Business for several years, and then at the design school, the Hasso Plattner Institute of Design at Stanford for a few years. And from that class kind of came the backbone of my book, Hooked: How to Build Habit-Forming Products, which is all about customer engagement and retention. How do you build the kind of products that people want to use as opposed to the kind of things that they feel like they have to use? And so that book came out in 2014. It's been about 5 years now, and it's been great. It's sold about 250,000 copies to date, and it's wonderful. I see it in a lot of places. I hear stories from people who use Hooked in ways that I'm very, very proud of. You know, companies like Paga that have brought millions of previously unbanked Africans online. Kahoot, the world's largest educational software, used the Hook model. Fitbod is a company that uses the Hook model that I invested in. I'm sorry, not Fitbod. I didn't invest in it. I invested in Kahoot. Fitbod is a company that builds exercise habits for people. And so what we've really seen is a democratization of these tactics to help people build healthy habits in their users' lives. And I'm super proud of that. And then that all led me to what I'm doing now, which is around the subject of distraction. That, of course, you know, I think habit-forming products can do a lot of good, But I think sometimes we can overuse them. You know, they become so good that sometimes they become distractions. And so that's what led me to write this next book, Indistractable.
That's what I find fascinating with this, the two books that you've put together so far. It's like, it seems like there are the two sides to the same coin. So on one hand, as a marketer myself, I want people to get hooked on my app. But this book that you're, this new book is about pulling away from that being hooked. What are some symptoms that you see someone is starting to get too addicted to technology, or too hooked essentially to technology?
Well, so we want to make sure we use these words precisely, that, you know, nobody using my book is using it to get people addicted. Addiction is an unfortunate byproduct of any analgesic. So anything that solves pain is potentially addictive to someone. So we would never want to addict people. Addiction is defined as a persistent compulsive dependency on a behavior or substance that harms the user. So we would never want to harm the user. And there's a few reasons why we don't want to do that. Number one, it's unethical. People who are addicted are not of sound body and mind. They can't make rational choices the way most people can. So they deserve protected status, or in much in the same way, you know, children, we have laws that say you can't market to children the same way you can to adults, because children are thought to not make the same quality of decisions. And so the same goes for people who are pathologically addicted. You know, the vast majority of people are not pathologically addicted. A lot of people like to think they're addicted because it gives them an excuse for overuse, but they're not pathologically addicted. Some people are, just like some people are addicted to alcohol or whatever else. But of course, the vast majority of us are not addicted. Now, from a business perspective, you know, not only is it a bad idea ethically to try and addict people or to knowingly addict people, because addiction implies harm, it's also bad business, because we're not idiots, right? People are not stupid. If they use your product and it harms them, guess what? They stop using your damn product. And so we don't want people to get addicted and then burn out. What we want is people to use our product and service because it benefits them in their lives, and we want them to use it for a very, very, very long time, right? That's how you have the highest customer lifetime value, is to make a product that people want to use for the rest of their lives. And you can't do that if you addict people and then burn them out. And so where you would find, you know, I almost never, actually, I can't think of even one company that came to me saying, hey, guess what? We have a product that people are overusing. Like, I've never, you know, SaaS software is not addicting anyone. Gym, you know, fitness apps are, that is not generally a problem. You know, education apps are not addicting kids. And that's the kind of products I work with. Now, some products, you know, when you think about games or social media, some products, some people do overuse. And there are ways that we can help people who are actually pathologically addicted. But that's not really, you know, that's not the people who read my book. The people who read my book are people who are building enterprise software and SaaS solutions. And, you know, those kind of products don't have this problem, to be honest.
I saw in one of your talks that you mentioned something about Acrasia or something like that. What is that, and how is that related to this book?
Yeah, so this term Acrasia comes from Socrates, and Plato talked about this nature that we have as human beings to do things against our better interest. And I cite this term because it's an example of how distraction is not a new problem. That, you know, 2,500 years ago, people were talking about how distracting the world is these days, right? And the same exact complaints that we have. And of course, if we're honest with ourselves, you know, if Zuckerberg shut down Facebook, people wouldn't start reading Shakespeare and Chaucer in their free time, right? They would do exactly what they've always done to distract themselves. They would gossip. They would watch soap operas. They would, you know, there are all kinds of things people have done to distract themselves from reality. And so that's nothing new. And we need to acknowledge that fact, that these technologies did not create distraction. However, if it is distraction you seek, it's easier than ever to find. That doesn't mean that we are hopelessly hooked. It doesn't mean we're addicted. It just means that we need to know how to defend ourselves. And so becoming indistractable is the skill of the century. Knowing these techniques for how do we get the best of technology without letting it get the best of us, this is the secret formula. This is the master skill that if you don't know how to focus and do your best work without getting distracted all the time, you are going to fall behind. That it is a huge competitive advantage to be the kind of person who can focus. But it is, you know, because so many of us seek distraction, and it is easier to find, sometimes we, you know, that can be a hard challenge. And so we need to learn these new skills, which are totally learnable. They're not hard to acquire. We just need to know what to do.
Now, we've been talking about distraction, and this book is about is called Indistractable. How would you define what a distraction is?
Yeah, so the best way to understand what distraction is to understand what it is not. Mm. So the opposite of distraction is not focus. The opposite of distraction is traction. Traction and distraction both come from the same Latin root, trahere, which means to pull. And you notice they both end in the same five-letter word. Both traction and distraction end in A-C-T-I-O-N, action. Mm. So traction is any action that pulls you towards what you want to do with intent. The opposite of traction is distraction. Anything you do, any action you take that pulls you away from what you intended to do. So this is very important to understand this dichotomy between traction and distraction, because it makes us have a much more realistic view of what these two things really are. That when we say we are getting distracted, the only way you can get distracted from something is if you know what you got distracted from.
Right.
So when people say they got distracted, my first question is, well, what did you plan to do with your time? And it turns out that 2/3 of Americans don't keep a schedule. No schedule, you know, blank white days, right? If you don't plan your day, somebody else will. So I don't want to hear that you're distracted if you don't know what it is you got distracted from. In this day and age, if you don't plan your day, somebody else will. So you have to plan not only your day, every minute of your day. And people say, oh, that's like a lot of work. I don't want to really do that. Well, tough. Welcome to 2000, you know, welcome to the age we live in. This is the cost. This is the price of progress. This is the price of being able to connect with everyone in the world for free, like we are doing right now with these free tools, having the world's information at your fingertips, endless entertainment. The price of all that is, yeah, I'm going to ask you to make a calendar. I'm going to ask you to turn off your notifications. I'm going to ask you to prevent distraction with PACs. And I'm going to ask you, most importantly, to analyze your internal triggers. Now, let me talk about internal triggers for a minute, because it's super important. It turns out that the number one source of distraction are not what most people think. Most people think that distraction is what I call an external trigger. You know, the pings, the dings, the rings, all of these things in our environment that come from our phone, from our computer, from our technology, that distract us. And they are certainly a source of distraction. But the number one source of distraction are not the external triggers. They are, in fact, the internal triggers. That most distraction, by and large, comes from within us. Why? Because distraction, we turn to distraction as pain relief. When we feel something we don't like to feel, we look for psychological pacification, like a baby sucking on their pacifier. And so we turn to our tools to escape something we don't want to feel. Now, this is really important to understand, because it means that if all behavior is inspired by a desire to escape discomfort, that means that time management is pain management. And if we don't learn to deal with our discomfort in a healthier manner, we will always get distracted by something. Right? Whether it's too much television, too much football, too much news, too much book, whatever it is, if we don't learn how to deal with that discomfort in a way that pulls us towards traction as opposed to distraction, we're always going to get distracted. And that's what I think was missing from a lot of the books out there in this space. You know, they'll give you tips and tricks and hacks and all that stuff. But if you don't fundamentally understand why we get distracted, the deeper psychology of distraction, you'll always find something.
Now, you talk about like planning out your day. And like, that's one way to make sure, you know, you have a plan. And the reason why I get distracted is you're pulling away from that plan. Is there ever a point where like somebody over plans their day, where like it's just too much planning?
Well, you've only got 24 hours in a day. You can't, I mean, I probably wouldn't plan in increments of less than, you know, 30 minutes. If you've got a bunch of small tasks to plan, I would just batch those tasks into a 30-minute chunk. But no, I mean, if you look at my calendar, every minute is accounted for. Now, do I sometimes fall off track? Of course I do. Becoming indistractable does not mean you never get distracted. The definition of becoming indistractable is that you are a person who strives to do what they say they are going to do. And so the difference is, when you plan your day, when you can look at your calendar, by the way, I'll give you a link that you can put in the show notes.
Nice.
For a tool, a free tool that anybody can use to plan their day. It's a very simple tool that, you know, I think Gmail is, or Google Calendar is kind of overbuilt for this. So I built my own tool for it, which I'll share with you for the show notes. When you have that calendar in front of you, when you have a well-planned day, and I do this only once a week, right? I review this calendar once a week. it finally tells you the difference between traction and distraction so that you don't keep getting distracted. You know, there's that quote that insanity is doing the same thing again and again and expecting different results. And so, you know, this was the story of my life, right? That, you know, I didn't write this book because I have a lot of self-control. I wrote this book because I don't have a lot of self-control and I needed a system to help me stay on track. You know, I used to be clinically obese. I used to be constantly distracted. And so I wanted to figure out methodology to help me do and accomplish the things that I wanted to accomplish. So the idea is that it's not that I never get distracted. It's that I don't keep getting distracted from the same thing again and again, like an idiot. Now I know why I'm distracted and I can do something about it. And there's only three reasons for every single distraction. So when a distraction occurs, when I go off track, right? And the only way to know if you went off track is to write down what you got distracted from with a calendar. Now I know, okay, was it an internal trigger? Was it that I was looking for escape from something I didn't want to feel? I felt bored, I felt lonely, uncertain, fatigued, whatever it might be. Okay, there's strategies to deal with that I talk about in the book. Was it an external trigger? Was it a ping, a ding, a ring, something that prompted me to get distracted? Or was it a planning problem that I thought something would take this much time and really it took much more, much less, or I didn't account for it properly? Now I can do something about it. That's the idea here behind becoming indistractable.
Now, do you also plan your days off or like after? Sure. Do you only plan 9 to 5 or do you also all the way from waking up to sleeping and also your weekends?
Yeah. Yeah. And look, it's totally fine to have big old chunks of white space, right? If you want time to go on a long walk, if you want time to watch television, oh, I'll give you a great example. I used to check social media all day long, or email was even worse. I'd check it all day long. And so that wasn't healthy because, you know, in the middle of focused work time, whenever I felt bored or tired or, you know, needed a break, I would constantly check my device. Well, now I have time in my calendar for those things. So I have time in my calendar for social media. There's nothing wrong with social media. It's wonderful. But use it on your schedule, not on the app maker's schedule. So instead of using it every time I'm feeling bored or lonesome or indecisive or fatigued, I use it at that time of day. So I turn something that was otherwise a distraction into traction by making time for it in my day.
Even your vacation, like, do you also plan? So like, let's say going to Rome or Hawaii.
No, like, look, if you're not in a mode where you need to get stuff done, if I'm sitting in the beach, right. I don't need to put pina colada at 2 p.m.
That would be cool. That would be nice.
Right. You know, this book is not for retirees. This book is for people who want to get shit done and have a lot to do. And so they might find themselves not getting done what they know they need to do every day. And so that's really who it's targeted for. So it's not for, you know, when you plan your ideal calendar, it's not planning your ideal calendar for when you retire. That's easy. It's for planning your calendar in the real world, which means you need to account for a lot of the nuts and bolts, right? Taking a shower should be in your calendar. Time for sleep, time to make healthy meals, time to go work out, time to take your kids to school. All those things need to be accounted in your calendar because if you don't take care of the little stuff, you won't get done the big stuff, right? People have these big dreams and they say, I'm going to write a novel. I'm going to start a business. But when are you going to do those things? You have no time in your calendar. What's going to give? And so, of course, they don't do them.
What do you do if you go over, let's say you allotted an hour and then it went over? Do you just adjust it for next week or the next time I do this task?
That's right. So the idea is to learn. So what you want to do is to reflect on the next go around and say, aha, okay, I got it. I budgeted this much time in my week for whatever that particular task might be, and it wasn't enough or it was too much. And so once a week, for me at least, that's the cycle time that I have is about once a week. Exactly once a week. Every Sunday, I have time in my calendar to sit down and look at the week ahead. Mm. Now, some people's calendar changes every day, in which case they probably need to plan some time the night before to decide what they're going to do the day ahead because it changes so frequently. But most people that I speak with, including myself, I do this once a week. And so I'll adjust and I'll say, oh, okay, last week I had too much time for email. Next week I probably will have a little bit more time for it. So let me adjust here and there for the week ahead. But then that takes literally 15 minutes a week.
Now, what happens when I do go over, like all the other things that I have planned kind of gets pushed down? Do I just adjust for that, or what is your suggestion for that?
Okay, so here's what you don't want to do. You don't want to succumb to what's called the what the hell effect. The what the hell effect. This is a known psychological phenomenon. I'm not making this up. This is a real psychological phenomenon where people, and you probably experience this, I know I certainly have, where, you know, when I used to diet, I used to be clinically obese, and when I dieted, I would say, okay, this is what I'm going to eat. I'm only going to eat this kind of food, etc. And then I would have one bite of chocolate cake or something. And what the hell, the day, I've already spoiled the day, what the hell, and the whole day I would eat crap. And that's not helpful, of course. And the same thing happens with our schedules. This happens a lot. You know, you sit down at your desk and you were supposed to start doing that big project at 9 a.m., but now it's 9:05, 9:10, 9:30, and you're still checking email or checking Instagram or whatever else, or talking to, you know, office gossip with a colleague. What you don't want to do is say, the whole day is screwed. I'll just do whatever I want. No, you just get on task with the next thing you need to do.
Now, this sounds like a lot of discipline required to go through this process. Is there like a piece about accountability partner or like a support group that can help you?
Yeah.
Like,
so there's a few. So one, I want to kind of challenge your notion that this is a lot of work. I think it's a lot of work to get started doing this. And by the way, you don't have to do everything all at once. You can take some small steps to get on the path to becoming indistractable. The most important thing is that you understand the strategy, not the tactics. The tactics you can come up for yourself. You know, the tactics are what we do. Strategy is why we do it. It's more important that you understand why we are getting distracted so that you can start to nibble off distractions throughout your day. But the really important four things you need to remember is that to fight distraction, we have to master our internal triggers, we have to make time for traction, we have to hack back the external triggers, and we have to prevent distraction with pacts. So those are the only four techniques you need. I mean, this is why this book took me 5 years to write, is because there's so much literature out there that I did not include in the book. I only give you the cream of the crop here, which are these four basic techniques, but you have to use them in order. So one technique that you kind of mentioned here, an accountability partner, this has been known for quite a while. People have heard about, have a friend keep you on task. And that definitely does work. But here's the thing, where it doesn't work is when people use that without doing the other stuff first. And that's what most people have not heard. That, okay, an accountability partner is great, but let me tell you, if you haven't mastered your internal triggers, if you haven't made time for traction, if you haven't hacked back your external triggers, this accountability partner stuff is going to backfire. It's not going to work. So you have to do that last. And that's not the only type of, that's called a pre-commitment. That's not the only type of pre-commitment you can use. That's only one type of pre-commitment called an effort pact. There are other pacts as well. There are price pacts. There are identity pacts. There's lots of different pacts that you can use. That's only just one of many possible tactics.
Let's talk about external triggers. One of the biggest, I guess, source of distraction for me and my wife, I guess, is our phone. So we get a ding, we get like notifications, like our game that we're playing or Facebook or thing like that. What are your suggestions for like setups in the phone or other things to make sure that the phone doesn't become a distraction?
Yeah, so this is step three, where we talk about hacking back the external triggers. And so when it comes to these external triggers, we there's a lot we can do. I mean, a lot of it starts with just asking ourselves, which triggers serve us and which external triggers are we serving, right? That's a very important question. So if, you know, an alarm goes off that tells you, hey, it's time to go work out, and that's what you plan to do with your time, terrific. That's leading you towards traction. But if something on your phone, you know, you're at dinner and you wanted to be with someone you love and your phone starts buzzing and now you're checking Pokemon or something, well, that's leading you towards distraction. And so there's nothing wrong with these games. There's nothing wrong with Pokemon or Candy Crush or Facebook or anything, as long as it's using it on your schedule, not on the app maker's schedule. And so the idea here is that we take, you know, I can teach you how in 1 hour, how you can turn your phone into an indistractable device. It's not that hard, right? You just need to go through your notification settings. So 2/3 of Americans do not change their notification settings. That's crazy, right? Why the hell would you not take a few minutes to change your notification settings? Some notifications need to stay on, right? Phone calls, text messages. Why does Pokemon need to interrupt you while you're at work? Or with friends? I don't know. Those are terrible distractions, right? Or more so, you know, we know that a lot of people out there sleep with their cell phones. People, do me one favor. Don't even buy the book. I don't care if you buy the book or not. I can help you a lot. But please, for your own sake, do not sleep with your cell phone. Okay? Sleep with someone you like. Don't sleep with your cell phone. It destroys your sleep. It's the first thing you pick up in the morning. It's the last thing you check at night. It is not healthy. What you do, you charge your cell phone outside and you get this amazing new invention called an alarm clock. But people say, well, what if somebody needs to call me in the middle of the night if there's some emergency? First of all, that's one in a million, okay? That's the chance of that happening are zero to none. But let's say you're really scared that something might happen. By the way, you know, I want to be sensitive here. If you have, you know, a family emergency, someone's in the hospital and they might need you, okay, fine, you're excused. But short of that type of crisis, the chances are very, very low that someone's going to need you. So what do? Charge your phone in the other room and use do not disturb while driving mode. Do not disturb while driving mode comes on everybody's iOS device. There's something similar in Android as well. And here's how it works. If someone texts you while you're in do not disturb while driving mode, they will get a notification back. They'll instantly get a reply that says, I'm driving right now. If this is urgent, text me with the word urgent. And if they text you back with the word urgent, that message will come through. Same with phone calls. So I changed that. I hacked that a bit so that it says, I'm indistractable right now. Please call back later. And if it's, oh, and it says, if it's urgent, then text me the word urgent. And so if it's really urgent, which it never is, they'll find a way to get to you as well.
I want to shift on the other end. If there are any responsibility, and this might not be covered in the book, is there any responsibility for marketers or product owners to create apps or create their product to be more indistractable?
Yeah, so I think that when it comes to children, companies have a special responsibility. Children are a protected class. And I think when it comes to people who are pathologically addicted, so something I've been advocating for the past 4 years now is what I call a use and abuse policy. That the silver lining of all the data that's being collected on us these days is that these companies know how much we are using these devices. And so what I want companies to do is one of the few pieces of legislation that I do really support, nobody's proposed this as legislation, but I'd like them to, is to force these companies to have some kind of use and abuse policy. And I'm talking about the big social media companies that if you spend X number of hours a week, give me some number, right? 30, 40, whatever hours per week you spend on this device. By the way, keep this in perspective. The average American watches 5 hours of television a day. Okay. So let's not forget that this is not a new phenomenon. That's average. Okay. 5 hours a day of television, according to Nielsen. So if you spend, you know, whatever number of hours per week we deem as emblematic of a potential addiction, we should reach out, right? You should reach out and say, hey, you are using this device to a degree that may indicate you're struggling with addiction. How can we help? But that, again, is only for the people who we think may be struggling with an addiction. I think companies should do that because I think to knowingly exploit people who have a pathology is not ethical. But for the rest of us, it's our responsibility. And there's so much we can do about it. I mean, I've just given you tons of tactics, yeah. And there are dozens more for what we can do. So we are not powerless. I don't like this philosophy that these companies are doing it to us. I think that's rubbish. There's so much we can do here. The power really is in our hands. If you turn off the notification settings, there's nothing Zuckerberg can do to turn them back on. Right? He can't reach into your phone and turn them back on. Give me a break. So I think a lot of this is about a personal responsibility, with the exception, of course, of children and people who are pathologically addicted.
Now, I know my reasons for getting this book. I actually already bought it. Why should my listeners get this book?
So I think it's really about if you struggle with not doing what you say you will do. I think that for many of us, you know, we know what to do already. Right? If you know you want to exercise, but you don't do it. If you know you want to eat right, but you don't do it. If you know that you want to do that big project and somehow you keep procrastinating day after day. If you know you want to have great relationships with the people you love, but somehow you find yourself on your device instead, and you're wondering, why don't I do the things I know I should do every day? Why is my to-do list a mile long and I keep putting off, you know, the bottom two-thirds of it from one day to the next to the next to the next? This is your answer.
One last question. You said you've started companies and you've sold it in the past. What would be one advice to founders right now? And it could be related to the book, or it could be just overall from just your past experience.
Sure. So yeah. So to founders specifically, I would say to focus on engagement. And I think a lot of people get intoxicated with growth. right? And I know that, you know, I know I'm well aware of the name of your podcast. So no ding on that. But I like the second word of growth, marketing, right? Marketing is not just about advertising. A lot of people think marketing is advertising. No. Marketing is what informs the development of the product. And so if you want growth, you have to focus on engagement. Because remember, you can buy growth. You can pay a bunch of money to get a bunch of people to advertise for you. You know, go to Facebook, go to Google, go to the television stations, wherever. You can buy growth. What you can't buy is engagement. And so if your product requires repeat engagement, you have to understand the psychology of what brings people back. That's what my first book, Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products, is all about. So growth is super important, but it comes after engagement. If you have the kind of business model that requires engagement, a lot of products don't need repeat engagement, right? Some products are, you know, one and done. That's fine. You may not need repeat engagement. But if your product does require repeat engagement, focus on engagement before you worry about growth.
One last question here. Yeah. Where can people find this book? By the time this podcast has gone out, it should already be out. So where can people buy it, and where can people find any resources related to this book?
Absolutely, yeah. So my blog is at nearandfar.com. Near is spelled like my first name, N-I-R. And that's near and far, so N-I-R and far.com. And the book is called Indistractable, How to Control Your Attention and Choose Your Life. And you can get all kinds of free resources and tools at indistractable.com. That's spelled I-N, the word distract, A-B-L-E, indistractable.com.
All right, Nair, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for listening all the way until the very end of this podcast episode. I really do appreciate you. And I want to share with you three key takeaways that I've gotten from this episode. First, make time for traction. Now, in this day and age, if you don't plan your day, someone else will. Without knowing what it is you need to do with your time, everything is a potential distraction. So one of the things I've actually done since I've recorded this 2 weeks ago with Nir is time box my schedule. So I have tasks blocked out in my calendar of things that I need to get done the next day. So I actually plan out my day the day before. Sometimes I get through my schedule, or sometimes I do get distracted. But now I know if I'm being distracted from work I need to get done. I measure so I can optimize my schedule. Second, make time for distractions. Yeah, I know that sounds kind of counterintuitive, but that's one of the other things I've learned is if you don't schedule time for social media or YouTube or whatever it is that you like to be distracted with, you're gonna do it when you need to get work done. I've even scheduled in times for me to take naps. Now, I work from home most of the time, so that's possible for me. This helped me really focus on deep work when I've scheduled it. And third, reduce potential distractions. One of the things I've learned is to hack back external triggers. I've gone through my apps on my phone that I don't use and I deleted them. I turned off the notifications when I'm doing work. One way I get into a state of deep work is listening to music with a rhythmic beat. I like listening to hip hop, jazz, or lo-fi music so that I can reduce potential distraction and nobody can really get me off my work. If you've enjoyed this podcast so far and you found a lot of value with it, please support this podcast. I'm not sure if you know, this podcast is done by me. I'm a one podcast machine team, if that's such a thing. I record, edit, and create all my marketing materials for this podcast. I made it easy for you to do that. There's three ways to support me. First, tell a friend about it. Share a quote on Twitter or LinkedIn. And you can find some tweetable quotes at growthtoday.fm/58. Second, you can join the Growth Today Tribe mailing list. You can get a cheat sheet from this episode and all future episodes directly mailed to you. You can go to growthtoday.fm to sign up for the Growth Today Tribe mailing list. And third, support me on Patreon for as little as $2 per episode for some amazing content that you won't find anywhere else. You can go to patreon.com/growthtoday. My first 20 Patreons, you'll get all the perks at the highest level, which is unicorn level. For $2 per episode, which is 75% off. I will thank you in every episode for the rest of the year. So with that, I want to thank my early adopter patrons. I really appreciate you for making this happen. Jamie White from Las Vegas, Veronica from London, UK, Fabrizio Marcias from Brazil, and we have a new one. We have Nicholas Vargas from Sydney. I don't know, I'm getting all these supporters all over the world. I really appreciate that this is a multi national supported podcast. Thank you once again so much for listening all the way till the end. Other than that, as always, keep on growing. Passion, 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 passion.